Hello, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to Earthzone Productions podcast. I'm Helena Erebene, and I'm happy that you've come to join me for the second podcast episode for our team and our next team member that you're going to meet. Last week we had Somto, and she was talking about West African cosmology, and I hope you got a good insight into what that all is. The next person you're going to meet is with me here. I'm in Vienna, and Paul Chivers is in Glastonbury in the UK. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you very much, Helena. Very happy to be here.
I'm so happy to have you on the team, Paul.
Well, it's great to be part of the team. It's really exciting, and what we've been doing and discussing lately, and things we've been creating and writing, it's all really exciting.
It's been brilliant to have you. And how long have we been talking about West African cosmology and self-destructive stars?
Well, I didn't set a point in my diary when we first started doing it, but it has been several years.
It's been several years. It's been quite a while, and it's quite a journey. But I've noticed that the longer we go on, the more the team has become knitted together and more our roles are more clearly defined. So, why did I ask you to join, and why did you decide to join Earthzone Productions team?
Well, you and I have known each other for a long time, and we've done various projects together. So we had a background of understanding, and I have an interest in. I mean, I'm a white male, European extraction, and I'm interested in African music. I've studied West African music to a certain degree, as a drummer. I've studied under Ghanaian master drummer Isaac Tego way back in the 80s. I've studied Afro-Cuban drumming and Brazilian drumming. And I've taken interest in forward-looking and forward-thinking musicians and musicianship, so as well as the traditional, which it should be a very momentous sort of about the present, but it's also, traditional about the past. Looking into the future, I've always been interested in particularly a musician like Sun Ra. And so he speaks about space and the cosmos and about time and the space waves and so on. And this is a natural connection with the topics that you and I have discussed, and under the title of West African Cosmology and Self-Destructive Stars, there's just a huge amount of interest in that sentence for me. It was an easy yes. What we do within that is developmental, and that's quite exciting. So to work alongside Katrine Collenberg is really interesting because of her work with stars, and also, of course, the work that you've done previously has been of great interest on, on different topics. So that's sort of why I'm here, really. Apart from the fact that I have a very tenuous connection with Africa, being the fact that I was born there once upon a time, 61 and a bit years ago,
Wow, where were you born?
in Tripoli, Libya, not West Africa, but I was born on the North Coast. I
Wow.
spent just a few months there. But it's always been a place of intrigue to me.
Libya is definitely an intriguing place. And
Yeah.
we do hope to all of us go to Africa, to West Africa at some point in space and time. Now, when you said that we had worked together in the past, we've been working together, I think, since the early 90s.
Yes. I think we met in the late 80s and we started working together in the early 90s.
Yeah, so many, perhaps most of our listeners weren't even born then, but I can remember our last project, and we worked together. Well, you helped produce some of the music, the main song for a theatre piece that I wrote called When the World Comes to an End, Move to Vienna because everything happens there 20 years later. And my protagonist wanted to get in a time machine and go back to 1974. And the main song for the piece was called 1974, and you produced the music, and it was so beautifully put together and produced by you. And you kind of stepped in at the last minute as well, I remember, but that was so much fun that you could really get so engaged and you put your whole self into it. And it was such a last minute thing, and you were working full time and you had to take care of your family, and you just dove in and got behind the desks. So tell us a bit about your technical expertise as a musician, as a technician. We know about your that you studied West African drumming. I know that I remember that you performed with me live. You played the congas for me, and you were known for playing the congas in clubs to DJs, to live musicians.
I did, yes.
But tell us about all your background in electronic music and in percussive music, and how that applies to this project for Self-Destructive Stars and West African Cosmology, if that's not too long a question.
Well, just historically, you know, I think I picked up a drum kit from a friend of mine in the late 70s. So being a sort of 16-year-old punk rock drummer, you know, all that sort of teen energy had to be channeled somewhere. And that was a great place for me to channel it. And then over the course of the next, I suppose, 10 years, I discovered conga drumming through my friend Oniruddha Das, who was playing congas with Pinsky Zoo, like a very hard, fast jazz, Ornette Coleman-inspired a band, sort of moving into the sort of funk electric bass, but very kind of intense music. So I was working with Oni, and he showed me how to play the congas. I decided to get some lessons, and living in London, it's not difficult to find conga lessons. Went to a few and found myself at Janako Arts on the Balls Pond Road with Isaac Tego, who was a Ghanaian master drummer. And wow. He taught me a lot, and I studied hard. I really worked hard on it. I really found my place in a way. And during that time, sort of 1986, 1987, at the end of 87, I bought a digital sampler influenced by the works of Morris Gould, aka Mixmaster Morris, and The Irresistible Force. He showed me how to use that technology. And so I bought in. And of course, with the first thing I sampled was myself playing the congas. And with a sampler, I know a lot of people. I walked into a studio about, I guess, a year later, and I said, "Oh, you got a sampler in here. You know, what do you use it for?" And they said, "Strings, mostly strings." And I thought, "Wow, that's a luxury." You know, it's like you just use it, because I used it for everything, my entire compositions. I was empowered as a composer by having the sampler. So, but it was a very interesting instrument. If you take a sample of yourself playing congas, and you might play it back on a keyboard, and you can press middle C and you hear what you played and you edit it. Well, what happens if you play it an octave lower? What happens if you play it two thirds down the keyboard and you find that there are rhythmic timings that make a 2/3 rhythm or a 3/4, and these combine? What happens if you put your elbow on the keyboard? What happens if you sit on the keyboard? You know, incredible sounds started to happen. And it was during that time that we had a sort of acid house explosion, and I went into that world. I was invited into that world because Oni and I were rehearsing with drum machines and bass lines and percussion, writing our own material. And so things would happen, like we'd get a knock on the door or a telephone call. So I was playing raves. We were also touring, supporting Susie and the Banshees when The Cure dropped out. And one of The Cure had seen us play a gig. We had a band with the name Delhi for Delhi, with songs entitled The Romans in Delhi, where I would play two trumpets at once over these drum machine and timbali and conga rhythms, with a bass line either played live by Oni, who went on to found Asian Dub Foundation. So that sort of heavy, heavy bass, or be programmed on a TB-303. And so with this editing background in sampling, and with this live performance background, but also sort of, I'd just done 4 years at art college. So, you know, I was, you know, pretty happy to sit on a keyboard and see what happened. but also pinning it down into the sort of the acid house thing. I got invited in this rehearsal room with Oni to come and play at a rave that was being put on there by Finbar, actually, is a great one of the original rave promoters. And I use rave advisedly. It's a simple expression to which takes in quite a lot. But, you know, acid house parties, as the newspapers used to call them. So I played to, I guess, 500 people at the Brent Black Music Co-op, also called HOMAC, Home of Music and Culture, in Dollis Hill, where we rehearsed. It was just a rehearsal studio, but it would get booked out for an all-night party. So I actually ended up doing quite a few there, but the first there was for Finbar. I guess 500 people, something like that. All the rehearsal rooms had been booked out. There was a DJ in one, there was live in another. That was a huge experience. And the next one, I got invited by Finbar to play live at in a riding stable in Iver. It turned out to be Back to the Future for Tony Colston Hayter, who was probably the most notorious promoter.
And then the next one... Why do you say notorious? Was he notorious?
If you look him up on the internet, he was an expert gambler who would get banned by casinos for knowing how to play the cards, how to count cards. I think he's, you know, maybe somewhere on the spectrum, high functioning.
Oh, right. Okay.
You know, he earned a lot of money. And I think he put a lot of that into it, quite possibly into raves. And right. But he had to deal with quite a lot. And he was a bit of a cheeky chappy and ended up the wrong side of the law. And that did get the better of him. I'm not sure of his whereabouts at the moment, but he spent some time at Her Majesty's pleasure. An amazing character. I mean, we did have some great conversations, he and I, and I booked various people for him to come and play at his parties. I tried to book Talvin Singh, but I think Talvin was abroad at the time. But Talvin was, I'd met him in a rehearsal studio as part of, you know, because I was playing congas so much, end up rehearsing at places like The Premises. So I would meet Talvin, who was rehearsing with Najma Akhtar at the time, who's just released an album. And everything was quite buzzy. And in the band I was playing with, we had, which was The Explosions, we were about to sign to. Who were we about to sign to? I think we licensed something to Acid Jazz. We're talking 1988 here, 78, something like that. And we were having chats with Big Life. That's right. We went to meet Jazz Summers at Big Life. Some things, you know, like cast your rod, some fish bite and some don't. That was a don't. We had some small releases. But, you know, I ended up playing with the rhythm section from the London Community Gospel Choir, who were tight. And during a break...
Well, hang on a minute. I remember some of them, and down at one of those community centres, some of them were singing. And that, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that when I met that jazz drummer?
John Stevens.
John Stevens. Did some of them sing down there? And didn't I meet John Stevens down there? About down there, and I can't even remember the name of the place, but there was a...
I know exactly what you're talking about. You're talking about community music.
Community music.
Which found its way to a great home in Farringdon where several events would be put on. It used to be an old film studio. Great spaces for events. And I built a studio in there. Oni had a studio upstairs, which became Asian Dub Foundation Studio. So John Stevens was a founder of community music and
taught there.
I'd already studied with him between 86 and 87 for a year, studying his, improvisation.
Was it called
theory.
Search and Reflect?
He wrote a book called Search and Reflect, a series of workshops about improvisation to make you forget all your licks, make you forget everything that you've known before, and take things down to what he called fundamentals. So the shortest note possible that you could make, how, you know, whatever you think is that, he's going to tell you that's not it. That's not short enough, you know, and a long note would be how long can you sustain your breath? And then these would be the fundamental elements that you would then apply to the various workshops, like click piece, dot piece. What's the difference between a click and a dot? Some fantastic pieces about counting.
Wow.
There's a great piece called 1-2, where if you say, you're working with another musician, and if you say one or two, which could be, of course, a note on your instrument, if you play them at the same time, you have to start again, and you interrupt each other, or you try and find the space between each other. Great, great things just to make events, musical events happen. But if you imagine an ensemble taking some of these ideas and playing them together and working together. It's just a fantastic experience. I'd come from West African drumming into that. So I'd come from the groove into absolutely losing the groove and talking about deep structure, about what's below that rhythm and what's below that rhythm and what's below that rhythm. Some people call them circadian rhythms, I suppose. That's a reference point. But also, what if there is no rhythm? What is it about time and space? What if it's about a star in the firmament, which is not necessarily, you know, a mathematical distance from the next one? How do you interpret that? I've made pieces, improvisational pieces, where I've tried to make these drum machines make the smallest possible noises and make them play out of time with each other so that they create random coincidences and random patterns that, you know, perhaps jump off each other.
Are not so random after all. Maybe there's some...
Taking a giant leap, okay, into cosmology. One thing I've learned from Katrine's recordings of stars, where she takes...
So we're talking about... So I just want to speak to the audience here and say we're talking about Katrine Kohlenberg, who is a part of the collective of Earthstone Productions. She is a cultural cosmologist, an artist, and an astrophysicist. And Katrine has created music from the stars. Yes, she has recorded star sounds, and she has contributed to her star sounds and is going to work and has already started working collaboratively with Paul. So Paul is now going to explain how the star sounds work and how he's working with them. So continue.
Okay. And then I would like to add afterwards what thoughts I've had opening up from it. So Katrine records the movement of light from the stars. Obviously, we can see movement of light, twinkling stars with the naked eye. But what Katrine has managed to do is focus on individual stars and record the movement and transpose that into sound. And then she transposes that sound into something audible to the human ear. Because, of course, light waves travel at different speeds. They have to be transposed into sound. That might mean a transposition a million times to get it somewhere audible.
Right.
To us. But they're measurements, they're mathematical measurements. And so where I come in is to take artistic license with that scientific data. I'm not analyzing it in a scientific way. I'm doing, well, really sort of kiddie steps when it comes to science. But
wouldn't you say that what Katrine is doing is also artistic license? Because I think it's a lot like the James Webb telescope, because there's a lot of artistic license in that. There is not exactly what you see. So there is always going to be a creative element when it comes to recording something that is actually not able to be recorded. So there's always going to be a subjective perspective and interpretation on what you end up seeing or indeed hearing.
I'm taking some very basic elements and we're now looking at the potential. I've sketched out some things and they're great things to listen to, but it's fun also to pursue some of the data. So what are the coordinates of this star? And how does that compare with the coordinates of another star? And if we have the sound of those two stars, how can we relate them to each other in a three-dimensional sound space? So a three-dimensional sound space might be represented by immersive audio or surround sound or a multi-loudspeaker setup. And that's exciting when you place them next to each other, because Katrine's already created something from them. So I'm taking those elements and then making something happen with them. So her recordings are...
Artistically, you're going to take those sounds. You're an audio, a sound engineer. You're a professional sound engineer.
I talked about my beginnings, my origins. I'm now jumping and skipping the middle bit. I'm now a professor of electronic and produced music at the Guildhall. So that puts me in a position where I offer the benefit of my experience over the last 40-odd years, 45, 50 years almost, I suppose, of dealing with my interest in music, which developed into an interest in sound, of course, slightly more fundamental because it then applies to sound art, or to, it could be scientific to a degree, not to perhaps to Katrine's degree. But we deal with, you know, sound engineers deal with frequencies, and we deal with mathematics. We deal with attack times, release times, which can be related to tempo. So there's enough mathematics going on. But within that, we have to decide what sounds good. So you might put in some mathematical coordinates which don't stimulate the response, you know, in any meaningful way. You have to make it meaningful, because I think music and our response to sound is emotive. And as artists, I think that's our territory.
Right. So artistically, how is all that going to be put together in this project? How are you going to implement these star sounds and your musical background into West African cosmology and self-destructive stars? Because it all sounds like it's making more sense, because I think when you think about, or when people first hear self-destructive stars and West African cosmology, they're like, oh, well, what's one got to do with the other? But as you're talking about what you do and your background, you seem to be like a really interesting link between the two.
I'm on a journey which is laid out. The destination would be the West African cosmology, because that's something that I need to direct my work towards to complete the brief. So I'm interested in that, but right now I'm on the journey of getting the data from Katrine, putting it into a context that I feel makes sense to me as an artist. And the further link would be then to understand how to integrate that into West African cosmology. So the cosmology, you know, is really something that I need to be informed by to help me direct my creative process. I'm at a stage before that at the moment, because I can take things that are a little bit more fundamental and non-specific. They're specific to the stars, and I'm using terms like constellations and the firmament to be able to contextualize positioning of stars and how I can use frequency control and pitch control to emulate an artistic impression of a journey through those stars. And the reason for the journey is we then get to feature a lot of the recordings that Katrine's made. Each of those stars sounds different, and there are different types of stars which have a different category. So I think there are about three categories that Katrine has identified. One of them, for example, being a pulsar, and the word pulse implies movement and a rhythm, and you can hear these differences. They're very tangibly different. So yes. I'm at this stage, and I can play with things in terms of, if you imagine yourself traveling through space, that there's an enormous pulsar on your left, and to your upper right there's a star of a different category that's giving you a different, or perhaps if they're both pulsars, how do those pulses interact? What does that do rhythmically as you pass through them, and as you approach, and as you reach the apex of the impact of the sound, and as you pass them, what does that actually mean? And I'm playing with those at the moment. My direction, if the destination I have is West African cosmology, well, that's a very exciting destination. But right now I'm somewhere out in the middle of space.
Yeah, so, and that sounds really exciting, because as you're talking about what you're doing, it makes me feel that if the listeners are piqued by what you're saying and what we're doing, then they can come on this journey with us, because it is a journey, and it's an experiential journey, and it's also, well, a research project. So it's like a big experiment about life, and about our origins, and using stars and using West Africa just as an example. It sounds niche, but it's not. I think it affects everybody from wherever they are in the world.
I'd like to take your use of the word life to refer back to before I started describing this section of what we're talking about today. I really find from Katrine's work that there's a lot of life. We're looking for life on other planets, you know, as a species. Is there life on Mars and so on? I think it's quite clear there's life out there because of the vibration and movement. I mean, that is life. That you know, only death is silent. Who said that? There's a writer, The Politics of Noise. I'm trying to think of his name. A French author. Fantastic writing that really explains. You know, they're so simple when you look at it like that. Only death.
Maybe it will come back to you at some point, or we can put it in the thread or a chat once this has been posted.
Well, if you can handle some typing noise, I can find out who it is. Noise.
do have some keyboard fingers on.
Yes, here we are. It's Jacques Attali. Noise, the political economy of music. In his, it's translated from the French. It's a heavy book, but it's quite intense. And the opening page, let alone the opening chapter, is a full on description of in huge detail of his concepts of life, noise, energy, and death, and the absence of it. And he's very clear that the way, if we have noise is life. There's background noise to our conversation. If I take my headphones off, I can hear what's going on outside. It would be very, very strange to hear the absence of noise. An anechoic chamber, apparently, I've never been in one, is a very disorientating space. But you still hear sound, or you hear your internal organs, because
right,
there's nothing else to be heard. So, of course, when we go to sleep at night, we can hear our heartbeat. So it would be that in extremis. The sound of silence. Well, you know, it's very hard to, John Cage will tell you, it's very hard to find silence. I love John Cage's 4 minutes, 33 seconds. The performances of it are all fantastic. There's a really good one that's at the Barbican made, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago. It's on YouTube. The orchestra plays to the conductor. The conductor plays to the written instructions written by John Cage. And the audience they can barely contain themselves. The most fun moment is between the passages, because there's a part one, a part two, and a part three. So as the conductor rests the orchestra, he also rests the audience, who start coughing, all the coughing they've been desperately trying to hold in.
Yeah, coughing.
They're desperately trying to hold it in for each section. And it just speaks so much of humanity. It speaks so much of the way we live our lives. Everything that's a construction, the hall in which it is performed is a construction. The manner in which it's presented is a construction. And I think John Cage spent over a year developing the piece, writing the piece, making it work, because it's all about the framework in which we live our lives and how do artists present themselves. We're not islands, you know, we're not in a vacuum.
We relate
to each other. And so when you look at African cosmology, you're talking about a specific framework. So, you know, we all have these frameworks within which to make reference. Interestingly, there are people who specifically want to branch out of the framework within which they have grown up and experienced, and want to take it further. And, you know, these artists become known and celebrated because now you can see them. And there are lots of people who work within cultures that, unless you live in that village, you don't know. You know, there's amazing work, amazing people doing amazing things. So, you know, all we can do is open a window and perhaps have a little glance, you know, at a microcosm, or we can look at an overview perhaps. And then I'm reading a great book at the moment by John Miller Chernoff. I should say I'm rereading it. I read it 30 years ago. It's basically African rhythms and African music. And he's an American Harvard graduate who goes to live in West Africa. I think he goes Ghana, he goes into the north, he goes into Nigeria, and he studies and he lives with And there's some really interesting things that he says, which I think are increasingly relevant. They're my window at the moment into African culture. In terms of cosmology, I need to make that leap next. But he's basically talking about how he is accepted into the here and now, and he's become a part of the tradition, because he, not to say that that's a 100-year-old tradition that he features in. He features in during the 1970s when he's there. He's accepted as part of the life of the people around him. And that's, he knows he's a musicologist. He knows he's an anthropological musicologist. And so he tries to justify and explain that in Western terms. But he acknowledges that to understand it better, you have to let go of that and accept yourself as part of that culture. You've walked into it, and that nobody's ignoring you. And if they're teaching you how to play the drum with the cat's hand, with the sticks of the forefathers, the drumsticks of the forefathers, which he puts under his pillow, or doesn't, as the case may be, and then is worried about the tradition. Have I broken the tradition by not sleeping with them under my pillow? So he takes it to his teacher, who says, well, that's your choice. You know, it's really...
Right, it sounds really exciting. Well, what I feel is that when we, or when you mention West African cosmology, that it's behind a curtain.
Yeah.
So I get the feeling that you're there with your tools, you're there with your knowledge and experiences, but then there's something that needs to be unveiled.
Absolutely.
And I think that what this project is trying to do is to unveil something behind that curtain that we've all feared. And I think there's a lot of fear and distrust, and there's been a lot of it's basically West African cosmology has been put down, and put down as something that's dark and perhaps even evil. Because and it might be something that's lying within ourselves, that it's projected onto that. But if you open that curtain, look behind that curtain, are your fears going to be revealed? Are you going to find that evil witch doctor, or are you someone going to put a spell on you, and is it all going to be so terrible, and death in the jungle, or all these things? I think that now is a point where it is like, okay, pull back the curtain, what will you see, what will you find? And I think this is a moment in time and space that's really exciting, because now we're traveling to the point where things are going to be revealed. That's the feeling I'm getting now as I'm listening to what you're saying.
If we unveil the unknown, you know, we only inform ourselves. Sun Ra said it's the unknown which we need to know in order to survive. Across cultures, there are people that know different things, and we have blanked ourselves, our vision. We've blocked our vision, and we're only slowly accepting that there's more to offer from other cultures. But I think in terms of colonial control, that's the environment in which we've grown up. And, you know, we can say, okay, well, there's post-colonial times, but colonialism, you know, it affects us all. It affects class culture. It affects race culture within Western Europe and the colonial powers. There's a lot going on there. There's an awful lot.
Artists
have the opportunity to jump across those things and to have, you know, we can take the criticism, but we have the opportunity within the framework of Western art, if you like, to go and look. So we can take from Braque, we can take from Picasso, we can take from, I can't think of the most obvious one who went into... Matisse? I'm thinking of Matisse.
Yeah, but when
Gauguin,
you think of
Gauguin, you're thinking of, perhaps.
Oh,
but they're all relevant.
Terrible with names.
They're
terrible
all relevant.
With names.
They kind of started things off for us in the West with the arrival of African and Asian art. You know, I read The Hair with the Amber Eyes. What's his name, the author of that? But he shares some of his cultural background. I share some of the cultural background with him, being Austrian Jewish. And he had family connections with actually the collection of Japanese what are effectively brooches, but there are these small, it's part of what he describes as part of a cultural and trade connections with the Far East, specifically in this case with Japan. And so these things arrived, you know, over from the 1800s, well, probably from the 1700s into the 1800s, and became part of Western consciousness. And so, you know, we have, you know, Buddhism is accepted and is practiced in the West. I'm not sure exactly how that. I'm not a Buddhist. I'm married to a Buddhist. You know, that's actually pretty much a non-practicing Buddhist when it comes to, as much as I'm a non-practicing Jew, or, you know, within our culture, I'm secular, and so is she, but the backgrounds are utterly different and the thinking is utterly different. And so,
well, when you're talking about those sorts of things, it makes me think that when you talk about being Jewish or practicing or not, or Buddhist practicing or not, I would like to see people saying, I practice West African cosmology, whichever division or tribe or region it comes from, in exactly the same casual or non-casual manner, without it being enveloped in fear.
Yes. I suppose a fear of the unknown is what resonates when you say that to me. I think, you know, we go to church on Sunday and we're pretty safe. You know, that don't go to those other places that you don't know about. That's a tricky one. There's so much out there, it's that scary. I mean, looking at the stars is pretty scary, but looking at planet Earth and how different people are and different, the differences are enormous. And so that can be quite scary. I mean, if you take a partner, a life partner from somebody within your own culture, you know, there are differences between families. Why do you do that? You know, I don't know. That's what we've always done. Oh, really? We don't cook our baked beans like that. We cook our baked beans like this. What are you doing that for? You know, there are differences all over the place. So within a cultural side, my father was grew up in a Baptist community with Sunday school and going to see his church and going to see the Welsh Male Voice Choir. It's another experience altogether. But as he returned, every time he returned to his village, which wasn't very often, the curtains would twitch and my father would say, yeah, they know who we are and exactly why we're here, because the community is strong. But there are differences within that community still. So it's pretty scary outside that community. We've got the big world to consider. So I understand what you're saying about fear is utterly tangible to me.
So look, I would like to ask you one final question, and it sounds amazing and exciting to know what you're going to do and to find out next what you're going to what's going to happen with your involvement with Katrine. Mostly, are you going to be performing live at all, or is your main involvement going to be the Star Sounds, your collaboration with Professor Katrine Kohlenberg?
I would love to put the work that we're doing at the moment between me and the way that I'm using Katrine's Star Sounds. There's a lot more to come. I would love to put that into a physical space where we can have an immersive experience, perhaps sound all around us. So as we look up at the stars, you know, we can bend our neck, we can look up and down. I would love that to be transposed into a real world situation. You can walk into that, you can experience some sounds. Yes, it's an artistic expression, an artistic interpretation. I think it would be huge fun and very emotive, and make us think perhaps about life on this planet, about life out there, about energy. You know, I love that. There is an old song I never used to pay much attention to, We Are Stardust. I mean, it then kind of spoils it by saying
Joni
we are gold. Joni Mitchell, we are Stardust, we are gold. No, we are. We're the same elements. We're the same elements. And, you know, that's...
Absolutely.
This is a fantastic
thing.
We are.
And that, well, you know, that's... Sorry, go on.
Well, that transcends borders on this planet.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. And it's really inspiring. As you're speaking, it makes me think, maybe the work can help us to realise that without technology, we don't necessarily need these expensive we don't need these expensive telescopes to communicate with the stars. That the music that you and Katrine will produce and play is a way of already communicating with the universe. Okay, maybe you needed some special equipment to record those star sounds, but maybe that could, you know, generate a way that we can transcend time, because once you look at the stars, you're looking at the past, that you're looking through at their light. So already you're transcending time. You're transcending time and space just by looking up.
Yes.
And once you start looking up and start to find ways to communicate beyond clock time, then you can really transcend clock time and you can go into timelessness and eternity, which is my goal. And I think this is all of our goals, to really find a new way to live, a new construction, to find a freedom beyond the past, the present, and the future. And that, I think, is possible. And I think that's one of the goals that we want to pursue with this project. So on that note, I want to thank you so much for
You're
that.
You're very welcome.
Extremely interesting and inspiring conversation. I'm really, really excited to move on to the next stage with this project. So Paul Chivers, I just have one more question.
Go on.
Your stage name is Ramjack. What does it mean, and who gave you that name, or where does it come from? Why do you call yourself Ramjack?
During that Acid House explosion, 87, 88, 89, I was reading a lot of Kurt Vonnegut, the author Kurt Vonnegut.
Yes.
I was enjoying a lot of his books. And the Ramjack Corporation is something that features in a number of his books. It featured in one I was reading at the time when I happened to need a name. I was getting asked to play concerts, and I had Oni and I had gone our separate ways with Deli for Deli, so I couldn't use that name anymore. And they wanted a name to put on the flyer, and I could have said Paul, I suppose.
Yeah,
but I didn't. And I said, oh, let's use the Ramjack Corporation, which then became abbreviated to Ramjack. And now that there's been an interest again in that era of music, so I'm now producing an album of those, the unreleased material from that time, and I'm re-releasing the old records, so that the people who put those records together, the re-releases, are using Ramjack Corporation, because that was on, I think, my first release. So my friends call me Ramjack instead of Paul sometimes, but my friends don't call me Ramjack Corporation. I suppose that would be like them calling me Paul Chivers every time they they just say Paul or Ramjack. But Ramjack Corporation was, you know, was from Kurt Vonnegut. The book Jailbird was what I was reading at the time, and the reason I chose it, why I thought it was appropriate at the time, was because in the Ramjack Corporation, it was a corporation in this book that was buying up everything in corporate America, with the basic idea of once you control it all, you can then pull the plug on it. And I thought that was a very subversive idea. And the woman who was the CEO of the Ramjack Corporation had disappeared underground, and she lived quite literally in the New York subway. And I thought that's a great metaphor for this underground music movement that was happening at the time. I just thought, there are enough pointers here to say, yeah, I'll use Ramjack Corporation. That's a good name. And so that stuck. I did several releases under that name. And people have known me by that name ever since. And it's worked.
And so you mentioned that you've got a new release of or re-releases under Ramjack Corporation. Did you mention that?
In 2018, Cameroon Massive was re-released. It used to be on the label Erdile Discs. It was a release in 1990. And I have collaborated with Raf Reza, a young producer in Canada. We released something. We called it Raf Ram. So Raf and Ramjack, Raf
yes.
Ram. That was a piece of music that was made with no computers. It was all made with machinery. It was sort of harking back in a way, but, you know, it sounds both old and modern at the same time. And now I'm working on specifically on material from the Atari computer I used in 1980. I bought it in 1988, I think. I bought my sampler in 87, bought my computer in 88. I was instantly playing these raves. It went from that 500 in BBMC, it went to the Riding Stable 3000. Then I was playing 10,000 people at White Waltham Airfield, which made the Sun newspaper and so on. So that was all with that technology. And I dug it out of storage. I dug the spider's nest out of the floppy drive on the Atari, cleaned it all out, made it all work. I actually put it onto two reel-to-reel tape recorders and started playing out live with these tape recorders. So my live show has been two live reel-to-reels, my modern live show. But I'm playing all that old-school material. So even if you don't know those tunes, if you weren't there at the time, people come up to me and say they were, but people who don't come up, who weren't there, they say, that's amazing. It sounds just like what I used to go raving to back in 1988 and 89. Absolutely, because it was all written at that time, it has that flavor, and that's what I've kept for this album, which will be, I think it's going to be released in the new year. I've been editing it, getting it sounding really good. A really amazing mix engineer, Trevor Lancaster Smith. He's worked over the years on so many productions for people as a major label engineer. He's now built his own studio, and we're working out of there, and fluffypuppymusic.com. And so I have ramjack.co.uk. So between those two websites, cool.
That's how online... people can reach you.
You can find me there, yeah, and that'll explain a little bit more about what I'm doing.
All right, that's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing, Paul Ramjack. Looking forward to going to the stars with you and Wonderful. Exploring West African cosmology. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. It's been really great to talk about this, and I'm really looking forward to what we're going to do next. We've got some really great audio files already. They're sounding fantastic, so I'm excited about that and what's coming next.
Great. So watch this space, and we'll see you on the next episode.
Thanks, Eleanor.